800-715-2286. It's 906.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. One of America's greatest composers, George Gershwin, wrote Porgy and Bess and brought it to Broadway in 1935. Since that time, it's become a classic, but it has always been shrouded in a mist of controversy. Several years ago, a new version was staged for Broadway, which was also shrouded in a different kind of controversy prior to its opening. That version arrived in Charlotte last night for a week-long run at the Belk Theater, and we talk about it with the lead characters of Porgy and Bess later in the program. First, three Charlotteans who recently walked what is arguably the world's most famous trail, Spain's El Camino de Santiago de Compostela, or the Way of St. James. People have been walking it for over 1,000 years, and we're going to find out why these three individuals chose to do so. Bob Barrett is a psychologist in private practice and co-founder of Charlotte Pilgrims, an organization for people who have either contemplated or are planning a hike along the El Camino. He completed his trek, I believe, on September 23rd of last year. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Kathy Afrio is a certified professional coach. Her inspiration for walking the El Camino came at the Park Terrace Theater, where she saw Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez in a film called The Way. Is it about the trail?
It is. That's the backdrop. Mm-hmm.
I'll be darned.
I had never heard of it prior.
Okay. And John Laughlin is a retired executive who walked the trail between March 23rd and April 30th of this year. And you don't look any worse for the wear. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And you did your trip in 2012. Is that right,
Kathy? That's right. Mm-hmm.
First of all, a little history. What exactly is it's the most famous trail in the world. And I know that I've heard of it before. But when this topic came up, I thought, I have no idea what this really is. What is the El Camino? Why is it both significant and famous?
Well, it came about because a farmer was plowing a field in that part of Spain. And
when?
Back in the 9th century.
Okay.
And up comes these bones. And after the death of Jesus, James the Greater went to that part of the world to proselytize. And the story is, at his death, his body was taken back there and buried. So the farmer turns up these bones, and somehow there's a decision made that these are the bones of James. And the bishop comes running over, and they decide to build this cathedral there. Mm-hmm. And the bones are put in the cathedral. And the Pope gives a papal indulgence to the people who walk the Camino. That was encouraging people to walk across Europe and across the north of Spain. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, you're awarded the Compostela, which is the indulgence that gives you a ticket straight to heaven. You don't have to go to purgatory.
Is that still in place, by the way?
That's still in place.
Okay. So this dates back to the 9th century, the 8th century, something like that. And so people have been doing this originally as religious pilgrimages.
Correct.
And I'm sure that some of them still do it as a religious.
Absolutely.
Pilgrimage.
Some people are going to Mass every day, and it's a very deeply religious experience.
But not everybody walks it for that reason, I think.
Some people are having an adventure.
Why did you all three walk it? What led you? I know your – I'll start with you, Kathy, because we already mentioned that your inspiration was seeing The Way, the film with Emilio Estevez and his father, Martin Sheen.
Right.
What about that film lit a fire under you to want to do this?
You know, the short answer is I don't know. I as the credits rolled at the end of the movie, I said, I want to do that. And I had never even heard of the Camino, ever. Mm-hmm. I know it's on a lot of people's bucket lists, and I had never heard of it. And that was the winter time, and by June I was walking. So it was just, it just kind of got hold of me. There was something compelling about it. I have no idea what it was.
Okay. And you, John, you did this. You just finished your trek. What made you want to do it?
In my case, I've lived in Europe for a long time.
Okay.
I lived in the UK and Belgium, but I'd never been to France. I've never been to Spain, rather. Right. And I wanted to start in France, cross the Pyrenees, and walk the entire route. It was just something that had intrigued me all these years. I grew up as a Catholic, educated by the Jesuit priests. So there was a religious component and a physical component, and of course the mental challenge of doing something completely on my own. I'd always done things in groups, and I wanted to do this walk the route that had been traveled for so many thousands of years by all these people. Napoleon did it, and Charlemagne did it, and Caesar did it, and the Roman legions were headquartered along the way, and that was my fascination with it.
And what about you, Bob?
I had heard about it for years and years and years, and at 73, I thought, there's no way I could do this. And I had coffee with a friend of mine, Kevin Foley, who had done it, and he said, of course you can do this. And I said, I'm too old to do this. He said, that's ridiculous. You should go do it, because it's going to bug you until you do. Once you do it, it will leave you alone.
Ah.
The second time we had coffee, he brought me walking sticks, and I started walking.
Now, the Appalachian Trail is, I think, over 2,000 miles. This is around 500, so it is not a long trail in the scheme of things. Although 500 miles is a long walk, I got to tell you. What's the terrain like? You mentioned the Pyrenees. You're going uphill for part of it. Well, coming back down, one would think.
It turns out I was not really clever and started on the 23rd of March in a couple of meters of snow.
Yes.
And I checked into the Pilgrim office, and the lady said, the mountain, which is the route of Napoleon, everybody wants to walk the route that the army took. Don't go up the mountain. It's closed. Heavy fog, heavy snow. It's closed. And she went on and explained how I should do it on the road, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. But she had to come back to it, I think probably because I'm a male, and she said, I can tell you're not listening to me. The mountain is closed. Don't go up there. So I eventually followed her advice and took the road.
If armies have traveled this and people have done this for thousands of years, how is it? I pictured it as like the Appalachian Trail, like just a little trail. This is obviously not just a little trail.
Well, it's wide in places and narrow in other places. It's largely rocky, sometimes pretty level, but they're pretty strenuous uphills and downhills that are very rocky and complicated. It's a different experience from the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
And there's an infrastructure there to support. You don't have to carry a tent. You don't have to carry food. There are places to stay every night.
This is what fascinated me. Because it's been going on for so long, and I guess because this is a tourist thing, some tourists, well, it's not that tourists would do it, but it brings tourism.
Generates money.
Because people who would not necessarily be in that part of Spain are there to walk the trail, that this whole infrastructure has grown up around it. Did you have to, for instance, you knew nothing about this till this movie, so when you sat down to decide to do it, how much planning went into it? What do you have to know before you catch the plane and get off the plane and there you are?
Well, I purposely did as little research as I could as far as reading other people's experiences because I wanted to have my own. And I kept trying to talk myself out of it because I was like, this is ridiculous. I mean, I did want an adventure. My kids were going to be away at camp for several weeks, so I had a chunk of time, and I kept trying to talk myself into something that was less of a production and something I knew more about. And I think it was the discovery of a travel agency in the UK when I realized that I could stay in hotels along the Camino. That's when I was like, you know, I think I can do this after all, because I really was not into the whole albergue scene, the hostels along the way. And I mean, I'm not a complete princess. I've done Outward Bound. I've slept in the woods before. But at this point, at this point in my life, I didn't want that.
I'm with you.
So that's what I did. And so each village, I had a place to stay, a private room and a private bath.
Ahead of time?
Ahead of time. It was all booked in advance. And I was cracking on myself. I started calling it the Partial Princess Package. And I was like, I'm not going to apologize for this. This is my Camino. This is how I'm going to do it. And I learned along the way that everybody really is doing things their own way, having their own Camino.
And yes, the phrase "my Camino" seems to pop. I read a lot about this yesterday, and that seems to pop up a lot. There is no rule. There's no one way that you have to do this. This is an entirely personal experience. Has it always been that way?
Things happen when you go off on an adventure like this that are not what you anticipate, and that's part of the reason to do it. So you're going to run into roadblocks at certain points where you can't follow the trail exactly as it's laid out in the books or in the maps, and you have to figure out what to do. And I think people learn I'm going to do my Camino. I don't have to do the one that's outlined in this book, because this is what works for me under these circumstances. Just as John wanted to walk over the Pyrenees and found out he couldn't,
right,
he had to change what he was doing.
Well, in fact, as I read yesterday, there's more than one trail. I mean, it's and that's why the symbol of this trail is a clamshell, the kind of clamshell.
Scallop shell, actually.
Exactly. That's an important distinction, yes. A scallop shell, because it has those lines that all kind of come down in the V to a certain point. There are lots of ways to get to the end point, correct?
Correct. Yes.
How did you choose the way you would go? I know that you wanted initially to walk right, the way that the Napoleon walked.
I chose it because, lucky for me, I speak French, and I wanted to start in France, across mm-hmm. the Pyrenees. And strangely enough, I met very few Americans this early in the year and traveled a lot with French people, some Italians, from all sorts of walks of life.
Are there a lot of people on the road, on the trail? Is it clogged with people from various countries trying to walk this all at the same
time? At my time of the year, no. And I did it slightly differently in that every morning I got up, I did not know where I would sleep that night.
Mm.
So I set off, and it dawned on me that it didn't really matter. I was going to walk the 15 or 18 or 20 miles of that day. And whether I got to my destination or what I thought my destination would be at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock, it really didn't matter. So it teaches you how to relax and invent each day as you go.
How can it not matter if you don't know where you're going to sleep that night and it's March in the Pyrenees?
Well, it's a little challenging. You have to be have a certain fortitude, and you have to be lucky, of course. And I think the pilgrim route has a certain status. You have a pilgrim credential, which entitles you to a pilgrim meal in the evening. And normally, in my case, people came out and helped. If I needed to know where to go and where to stay,
mm-hmm.
I had an opportunity to talk to people on what to do.
Since you went in the middle of winter, there probably weren't a lot of people. But if you go in another time of year, if you go in the summer, if you go in the spring or fall, are you going to run into a lot of fellow travelers along the trail? Or is this really more of a solitary thing, and people really want to be alone with their thoughts?
You can be alone or you can be with people. I went at the end of August, and in Europe, everybody's on vacation in August, and there were lots and lots of people. But on September the 1st, I'd say 75% of those people disappeared. And there were plenty of days I walked almost all day by myself.
Isn't all of Europe on vacation in August?
That's right.
Yeah.
So they all go back to work.
Right.
But there were people around most of the time. There were sometimes I couldn't see anybody in front of me or behind me. And there were often wonderful, wonderful people with great conversations who walked with me.
Mm. Did you go by yourself, Cassia?
I did. Mm-hmm. I was going to just tag on what Bob said. I was there in the high season, end of June into July, and there were plenty of people around all the time. But even when there were people around, you still kind of had your own opportunity, whether you wanted to walk with people who you might happen to fall in step with and in conversation with, or walking by yourself. I mean, even in the midst of large groups of people, I walked several days all day by myself because that was how I wanted to spend the day or how it just turned out. So, and I was really worried on the front side about this mix between the alone time and the group time, but it all worked out. I had a lot of both.
I want to talk, as we go through this, about what you got out of this, and we'll talk more about the nuts and bolts of actually walking the El Camino with our three guests, Bob Barrett, Kathy Afrio, and John Laughlin, when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You may remember Webb Hubble's name. You may remember Webb Hubble. He was an associate attorney general of the United States and a longtime friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton. He was swept up in Ken Starr's Whitewater investigation back in the 90s. And after he pled guilty to wire and tax fraud charges, they put him in prison for, I think, 18 months. Well, now Webb Hubble lives in Charlotte, in Dilworth. and he's published his first novel. It's set in a fictionalized version of his hometown of Little Rock, and Webb Hubble will join us tomorrow to talk about that book and a lot more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some conservative groups say we should do away with the Export-Import Bank, which helps U.S. companies sell to foreign customers. The role of the Ex-Im Bank, the fight in Congress over reauthorization, and what it could mean for the economy.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The El Camino de Santiago de Compostela, the Way of St. James, is what we're talking about today. It's a trail that thousands of pilgrims have walked since the 900s in Spain. Bob Barrett is the co-founder of Charlotte Pilgrims, an organization that helps people get ready for this trip or helps them explore the idea of doing this trip. Kathy Afrio took it. She's an executive coach, walked the trail in 2012. John Laughlin, a former executive, walked it just this year, from March through April of this year. There is this Charlotte Pilgrims organization that I believe, Bob, you started, and people can email you at bob@docbb.com.
That's right.
To find out when you meet, and I know that you meet, I think, twice a month.
Once a month.
Okay, well, that would indicate that there's this critical mass of people who are interested in talking about this, who have done it, who want to do it, who want to know or learn about the possibility of doing it. How do you explain this in Charlotte, North Carolina?
Well, I don't know why it's happening here. It's happening everywhere, I suppose, that people are looking for some challenging experience. And for many, it's a spiritual or religious experience. And for others, it is, here's this route that people have walked for so long, and I can do pretty much what they did here in 2014. Mm. And so people become intrigued by that whole notion. And, you know, you get over there and you do what you do. Some people have 2 weeks, some people have a week, some people have 2 months. And they adjust themselves to just walking every day.
What does it cost to do this? I mean, if you just set out to do this, aside from the plane fare to get there, because you don't know how long it's going to take you, and you don't necessarily have to finish, but I suppose if you start, you'd like to get to the end. What does it cost?
It's an interesting question, Mike. I ran into the trap of not being able to sleep in the albergues, so dormitory style. I didn't do well with that at all. But
those
that's
are the hostels.
See,
hostels.
I saw that one ahead of time. That's why I got onto the hotel scene.
And that's the least expensive way of doing it. Typically €5, so $7 a night. You don't get an awful lot for $7 a night.
And you have to be out by 8 o'clock in the morning.
Be out by 8 o'clock, and all the lights are turned off by 10 p.m. It's a wonderful experience, but I couldn't sleep in them because bunk beds and me didn't do very well.
Okay.
So I had to increase the budget and stay in small farmhouses. One night I slept in a supermarket.
And they let you do that?
Well, the lady said she made my dinner that night, had the room above the supermarket, and she said, well, I'm going home now. Help yourself to anything in the supermarket, and I'll see you in the morning. And there I was with my bottle of wine watching the football on soccer on television. So I was very fortunate. As I upgraded, I found myself in bed and breakfast type accommodation, farmhouses and so forth. And, of course, that increased the budget. So to answer your question, you can spend anywhere from $30 a day up to $80 a day, depending on what you're faced with. But each day is different in that you don't know what the road conditions are, and sometimes they're really harsh. You don't know what the weather's going to be. For sure it's going to rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the terrain and the time that you've got and the weather conditions. But there's always a place to stop for refreshments along the way. I always had my beer around about noon every day and a sandwich.
Okay. Now, nobody in the room is 20 years old.
Right.
And as I said, as you said, Bob, poor. You're in your 70s.
Right.
You're somewhere in the neighborhood of 60, 65, I would think, right?
Well, how nicely put.
Thank you very and you're not. You're much younger.
I'm 46.
Okay. So this is not necessarily a young person's game. You don't have to be 20 to do it. What did you do to prepare? Because I know I read your story, and you said you thought you had prepared. But the idea, every day you were taping your feet and trying to figure out what parts of your feet were not going to work for you that day and to change your gait. Why was it so hard?
You know, it's really all about the feet. I was already a runner, so I wasn't worried about the actual walking part as far as the endurance. But the feet, breaking in your boots, which I had done with a friend in Charlotte. We walked 11 miles along the Greenway, and I was like, great. All right, my boots are broken in. I'm good. But I think the pack weight changes the way you're
yours
walking.
Yours was 22 pounds, right?
Yeah, I think it started a little heavier than that. I was dumping stuff early on because I was like, I could barely move around with that thing for 15 miles a day. I mean, that really adds up with what's happening with your feet. But also, you would have one blister start here, and then, you know, you're starting to walk different. Your gait would change, the pack's making that change. And it was like a game of chess, constantly figuring out which part of my foot needs to be taped now. And
did you ever reach a point in the middle of the day someday when you thought, why am I doing this?
Well, no, I mean, not exactly. But I did something I shouldn't have done one day, which is I was in such an incredible conversation with a person that I didn't stop when I needed to stop. And I'm sure he would have stopped with me. It wouldn't have been a big deal. But we were just in the middle of this long, deep conversation, and I kept going. And I kind of felt something happening. And the rule on the way is if you feel something happening with your feet, you need to tend to it immediately. Okay. And I didn't that day.
How do you learn these rules?
Well, I think you walk a lot before you go. And the biggest challenge is, of course, blisters. And everybody says have a blister plan. I thought I had one, but when I got over there, I realized I didn't have a blister plan. So I think you learn the rules just by doing it.
It's also important to walk with sticks. The trekking poles were the solution that I found because of the balance. They make you more efficient, 25%, 30% more efficient. But downhill is always harder than uphill.
You would think that would not be the case, but I once walked down the stairs of the Washington Monument, took the elevator up because they won't let you walk up, and took the stairs down. And about halfway, and you can't get the elevator halfway down. It starts at the top and it ends at the bottom. That's it. There's no stops in the middle. So halfway down, I thought my knees are going to give out.
Yep. Knees, lower back. And the sticks were my savior. They really made the difference. So to train for it, sure, walking is a good thing, but the gym was invaluable. Ah. The bike, riding the bike in the gym and the elliptical in the gym was equally good. But, of course, you have to test all your gear so that the shoes fit and the back fits. And I did mine with 12 pounds of weight.
Okay. Was that enough?
Yes.
Okay. Let me share some emails with you. Tim emails, are you able to sleep in a tent if you want to every night?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't care about that.
Some people carry tents and prepare their food. Not many, but some.
Tina on our website says, my son and his fiancée decided to walk the Camino de Santiago last February, and if they were still speaking at the end to get married.
Oh, God.
To get married in Gibraltar. We were there for the wedding in March in Gibraltar and hope to walk the Camino someday ourselves. What were the highlights of this trip for the three of you? Bob, let me start with you on that.
Well, there's so many highlights, but for me, I had a pretty serious infection going on in my foot, which I knew was every step was painful after about 2 weeks. And a highlight for me was deciding I'm going to keep going. I'm not going to stop. And there was almost every day, why am I doing this? And walking through these incredible landscapes, just astonishing landscapes, and some of the people I encountered reminded me that there are people all around us that we can connect with. And while those relationships on the Camino may have been fleeting, they were deep and enduring nevertheless.
You speak Spanish?
No.
Was that a drawback for you in Spain?
Not particularly. There were times I wished I could speak a little, but there were times it was not a big deal.
Highlights for you, Kathy?
I think the people that I met along the way, for sure, and to end up making really deep bonds with people just by spending a day walking, and some people you didn't see again, some people you might not see for several days and then fall back in step with them, and just incredible depth. I mean, you kind of cut through all the crap because you're walking on the Camino together and you're talking about reasons you're here, which was often lost for people. I found that to be a theme, even though people didn't know.
Loss. They were walking it because they had experienced a loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Quite a few.
John.
Similar theme. It's the people. I was at Mass in the Cathedral in Lyon on Palm Sunday, and the gentleman next to me took me home for lunch with his family. And that was a very nice experience. I'd not been to a private home mm-hmm. in Spain. So the people, for sure, made the difference.
You mentioned the credential. It's called a credencial, I guess, in Spanish, that people get before they start the journey. Where do you get that document, and what purpose does it serve?
The purpose is to state that you're a pilgrim, so you have your passport number in there, mm-hmm. and every night they stamp it. So at the end of the Camino, you have a collection of stamps from each of the places that you stayed.
I see.
And the towns that you stayed.
It documents that you stayed in these places.
Right.
So at the end, when you get your Compostela, they look to see, have you really done this? And the stamps validate that.
Christine emails, I've walked the Camino Antiguo, a branch of the trail which begins in the province of Asturias in the summer of 2004. I began solo and found a delightful group of Spanish pilgrims that I joined for the remainder of the journey. We stayed at the refugios along the way being the Way of St. James. It was a transformative experience in community, and I recommend Thorlow socks and 2 hiking sticks. There you go. You are justified, John. So you're meeting once a month for people who want to know how to do this and what to think about and how to prepare for this. Is that right?
We're meeting right now at the Great Outdoor Provision Company in the South Park Road Shopping Center on the third Tuesday of each month at 6:30 in the evening.
And we'll put your email up on our website. Bob Barrett, co-founder of Charlotte Pilgrims, the organization that meets to talk about this. Kathy Afrio, an executive coach who walked the trail in 2012, and John Laughlin, who just finished it a couple of months ago in April. Congratulations to all of you. It sounds wonderful. Maybe someday I'll have the guts to do it. The El Camino de Santiago de Compostela, the Way of St. James. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
George Gershwin had already written Rhapsody in Blue, An American in Paris, Concerto in F, and a host of popular songs for Broadway and Tin Pan Alley when he decided to undertake writing an opera. He collaborated with DuBose Hayward, who had already written a novel called Porgy, on what would become Porgy and Bess. Hayward wrote the libretto, Ira Gershwin the lyrics, George the music. That music was infused with the jazz figures that Gershwin found so enticing and which he had already used with such success in his previous works. But Porgy and Bess was different. Set in a fictional area of Charleston, South Carolina called Catfish Row, it opened on Broadway in 1935 with an entire cast of classically trained African-American singers. That cast and the opera's subject matter made it controversial from the start. Gershwin also insisted on calling his work an American folk opera, allowing it to find a home in opera houses while also being seen as a quintessentially American musical.
Oh Lord, it's a long, long way, but you'll be there to hold my
The show has had several Broadway revivals, but its most recent one in 2011 was viewed not only as controversial, but as possibly heretical. Once it opened, however, those fears were set aside as it won over critics and helped 21st century audiences relate to the story and its characters perhaps more than any other previous production. It is that production that opened last night at the Belk Theater for a week-long run, and we are joined for the rest of the hour by two members of that Broadway revival cast and the title characters in this company of Porgy and Bess. Nathaniel Stampley is Porgy. Alicia Hall Moran is Beth. Thrilling performances last night. Welcome to the program, and nice to have you in Charlotte.
Well, thank you very much. We're happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So, I love Audra McDonald, but I think you're better.
That's a great way to start.
and I'm curious about the curtain call, because the curtain call elicited almost melodramatic responses from the audience. And I just want to know if that happens everywhere you go, and whether or not it happened in New York. Because when the villains of the piece come out, they are both cheered and booed at the same time in fun.
Yes.
And does that happen everywhere?
Universally.
Really?
Everywhere. To a different degree.
Yes.
I think last night's crowd relished the opportunity to boo and cheer, but everywhere there is some difference in the appreciation.
Oh, absolutely. From New York to East Lansing to Dallas to San Francisco, that's been the case.
And Bess, there's a moment in the second act where Bess is tempted by a sportin' life to imbibe in the happy dust.
Yes.
And you think she's going to, and she doesn't, at least temporarily. She doesn't. And once again, the audience applauded her for her not doing it. Does that happen a lot?
You know, I think that when we're in cities that have a connection to what I called like a vaudeville history, you know, when they're laughing at the patter earlier in the show, when they're laughing at Mariah's zingers and one-liners, then I kind of anticipate that they're going to be involved in the way of melodrama. I love your word for it. So that there will be this like soap opera, no, don't do it, no, do it. Oh, she did, you know, but it kind of goes along hand in hand with their appreciation and ability to absorb that kind of humor. Like Las Vegas, they were very into the, like,
oh, really?
You know, the Abbott and Costello. It's, you know, it's 1935, the
right.
Opera. So some of the libretto by Hayward does also incorporate so much of that early American humor.
Right.
And I think it goes along with the
Well, you know, Sport and Life songs are very vaudeville. The way they're the way they're staged, the
yes.
way they're written, it's intended to be musical comedy, which is odd, it seems to me, for an opera. And he wrote this, George Gershwin wrote this, intending it to be an opera. We're going to talk about what has happened in this production to make it different from all the previous productions, and that's what made it. With the Export-Import Bank, which helps U.S. companies sell to foreign customers. A conversation about the role of coming up at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. When we come back, more with the leads in Porgy, the stars in Porgy and Bess. Stay with us.
WFAE's Public Conversations get people talking.
Is there any way for a homeowner to know in advance what type of homeowners association they're dealing with? I hear that there are some that are overly zealous. And maybe
if we've got greenway space, if we've got floodplain that is now being developed, what are we doing to preserve something?
Listen to WFAE for details on future community forums and come join the conversation.
For a week run at the Belk Theater last night at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center with Nathaniel Stampley, who plays Porgy, and Alicia Hall Morgan, who is Bess. The music, of course, is George Gershwin's. The lyrics by Ira Gershwin, his brother, and some by DeBose Hayward. I think he contributed to Summertime. And that's just illustrative of the iconic nature of the songs in this show. Everybody in the world, I don't care whether you were raised on hip-hop or country music, has heard Summertime at some point in their life, which puts a great burden on your shoulders, it seems to me, to have to sing it every night and make it yours. Does it ever go through your mind, all the people who have sung this song in the past, all the people who have sung Bess You Is My Woman Now, and here you are singing it, and you have a legacy to uphold. Does it ever cross your mind?
Well, I always consider, you know, any time you're in a production of Porgy and Bess, that you automatically become a part of the wonderful legacy of the show. I mean, it's, you know, over 76 years old, and so many of our greatest artists have been associated with this piece. So if my name is attached to someone, you know, from a range as Sidney Poitier mm-hmm. with the film to Donny Ray Albert on the Houston Grand recording, if I'm going to be in that conversation, then I'm all the happier for it.
You have one of the best male voices I've ever heard in musical theater, ever.
Thank you.
I got to tell you, it was magnificent.
Thank you very much.
How long have you been doing this?
Professionally, it's been about 18 years. And that was the last time, I guess, 19 years I had a temp job at a typing mortgages at a bank.
Are you serious?
Yes, back in Wisconsin. I grew up in Milwaukee.
God, show business is so glamorous. So what made you want to do this, both of you? I'd like to hear from you. What made you, because now you're at the top of your game. You weren't always at the top of your games. So what made you think you could do it? What made you want to do it? What has made it worth all of the ups and downs that people don't ever think about to do it?
For me, it was the list of directors. So Diane Paulus,
mm-hmm. who did this production,
yes, director,
who won the Tony for Hair, the reimagination.
Won the Tony for Hair, really powerful voice for, I think, the future of musical theater mm-hmm. and theater at large. This is, I mean, I hate to use, you know, like, how are you going to portray the lives of black people? How are you going to portray the bodies of women? How are you going to allow men to tell their stories and retell their stories? I think it's really wonderful that such a kind of progressive woman keeps getting asked to look at pieces from the past. You know, it's really important to be engaged, for me as an artist, with the past. I'm really primarily about the past. Mm. Singing in a Porgy and Bess was never on my wish list, to-do list. I went to see it at New York City Opera because it's a masterwork. And I also had high regard for all the performers in it. and maybe some idolizing of some of the performers in it. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, you see it as a matter of course to be part of the artistic discussion in the world. You see Porgy and Bess. But for me to be in it, that was never anything I ever thought about or thought was possible. I didn't think there was a role in it for me. And I, but Diane Paulus,
really, you
Deirdre
didn't
Murray.
Wait, stop. You didn't think there was a role in it for you?
Oh, no, no, no. Well, first of all, I'm a mezzo.
Okay.
So that right there. There's a chorus part for me in it, for sure. But I hadn't.
So when they said to you, you're going to, because you were in the original cast, I think you date back to the workshop production of this in Massachusetts. When they said to you, we'd like you to do this on the road, what was your first reaction?
Well, I'm a realist. So I was thrilled that such a high-level casting agency just called me at my house. I had have no agent. But I you told them I couldn't make it because I had a gig in San Francisco, like a jazz gig. And I remember saying, and nobody else knows the music. Because it was my husband's music, so I'm gonna. And they were like, "Well, maybe you could come back a month from now. We're gonna see one last big bunch of people." I was like, "Oh, of course." And I remember sitting at dinner. My teacher, one of my voice teachers, the late Shirley Verrett, beautiful, beautiful operatic soprano and mezzo soprano, had a memorial. They had a memorial service for her at the Juilliard School at Lincoln Center, and I sang on the program. And my room was next to Placido Domingo, who was a great colleague of hers, lifetime. And afterwards, we went to dinner, and I told my parents the news that I had this audition for Bess, understudy, for this new version they were going to do. Mm-hmm. At that time, I didn't know who the directors would be. I didn't know Ron K. Brown was a part of it. I didn't know Susan Laurie Parks was rewriting.
Ron was the choreographer. Oh. Susan Laurie Parks did the new libretto, or cut down the libretto.
Yes, and I'm a big top dog, underdog fan. That's her mm-hmm. Pulitzer Prize winning play. I'm a big fan of Ron K. Brown, Evidence, Dance Company. You know, previous, I'm a big fan of the cello playing of Deirdre Murray, who was then invited to look at the score and make a new piano voice arrangements that kind of take a further look at what has happened in jazz since 1935. Mm-hmm. Okay. What has happened in African-American music since. So like some of that vaudevillian has been, the rhythms have been coerced for their highs and lows through the, you know, you, or you could do, you can flip, it's the same idea,
yeah.
But depending where your emphasis is, where the bass up, you can, you know, bring it. Some the some of the reimagining she did, I feel so much like a part of hip-hop, or I feel like contemporary jazz, like you feel like Diane Reeves up there. You feel like so much permission to be a contemporary artist.
Well, I noticed that.
And that's why I did it. So that's my long answer.
Okay, well, I noticed a lot of that coming through a lot of people's performances, that it's not they're having fun with the melodies sometimes. You I think you did that. I don't think I heard exactly what you sang before. It's like you're taking some liberties with this because you're making it your own. But I want to go back to my original question about what mm-hmm. made you want to do this.
Well, my father is a pastor of a church.
That makes the question even more important.
Yes. My dad is a pastor of a church back home in Milwaukee, and my mom was a church musician growing up. You know, to this day, I try to sing as well as she does.
Wow.
And so...
must be terrific then.
Yes, she is. So growing up, I've been singing in church my whole life. When I got to high school, I was introduced to a lot of Gershwin. My mom would play a Gershwin at the house as well. But there was an opportunity to be in the opera chorus at the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee. And they just needed a bunch of bodies on stage. I was a teenager. I think I was 15 at the time. And I got a chance to, you know, be in the chorus of this incredible opera with these incredible artists from all over the world. And I thought, man, if there could ever be a day that I could get to be Porgy or do this, you know, as a profession, I'd be a very happy man. So here we are, decades later,
doing it.
Yeah, so that's where a lot of that comes from.
I want to go back to something we talked about before the break, and that is the fact that this is a reimagining of the show. This the original show is 4 hours long, and as you mentioned to me in the break, Nathaniel, even George Gershwin and the director in 1935 walked around Boston Common during the preview performances and cut 45 minutes out of the show on opening night because they kept saying it was too long, it's too long, it's too long. Well, this is 2.5 hours. So a lot of cutting has gone on, and I mentioned in the beginning that this got some reaction when this was in its workshop phase. It hadn't opened yet. No one had seen it. It was still in rehearsal, and a word leaked out that people were tampering with George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, and Stephen Sondheim, who is probably the greatest living composer in American musical theater today, wrote an article in the New York Times chastising Diane Paulus and taking her to task for doing this, and that caused an uproar. Somehow she was able to stick to her guns. And although you told me, Alicia, that Stephen Sondheim to this day has never seen this production, other people have been relieved to have seen the production and realized that his fears are not founded. But what did that feel like in the process? To have the god of musical theater say, this is a travesty.
Well, I know for sure, you know, we were in Cambridge at the time, and I know we all felt blindsided when this came around, this letter was produced, and I think it galvanized us as a company. Mm-hmm. We definitely became a lot closer together, and it put more emphasis on the work itself, not anything around the work, but the work itself. And I think, you know, it created a different focus in rehearsals, and but it definitely burst a bubble that we had created while we were at the ART.
And this is not the first time that Porgy and Bess has been the subject of controversy, because in 1935, having an all-black cast on a Broadway stage was unheard of. They did blackface minstrel shows back then still. So that was unheard of. And the fact that when it played, I believe, the National Theater in Washington, the National Theater didn't allow African-Americans to be in the audience. And the cast said, not only are you going to let them in the balcony, you're going to let them in the orchestra, and you're going to seat them with the white people, or we're not doing the show. And that happened. I mean, this is groundbreaking. And in 1937, 38, that was amazing. But there are some African-Americans who have problems with this show. And I noticed last night that, for instance, the vaudeville numbers, and I think you have one of them.
I Got Plenty of Nothing.
I Got Plenty of Nothing. Could tip into that step and fetch it kind of attitude that vaudeville allowed, forced black performers to move toward. This goes in the absolute opposite direction and brings the character of Porgy in a whole new light, and it's actually very funny in its own way, because it's now based on his relationship with Bess and not on some ridiculous notion of what African Americans are like.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the great things about revisiting a piece like Porgy and Bess with creative geniuses like Susan Laurie Parks and Diane Paulus is that, you know, the emphasis, especially if you're going to do it in a theatrical setting, is going to be on the story. A lot of time, more times than not in opera, it's about music first, mm-hmm. and then the plot, you know, well, good luck if you understand what's going on, but it sounds great. In our version, you know, because it's theater-based, it's emphasis on the story. So I know for sure, like, Susan Laurie Parks was big on, you know, a song like I Got Plenty of Nuttin' can be quite uncomfortable for people of color for many, many, many years. So instead of just having this happy song just sort of come out of nowhere, she put it in a proper context with the relationship with Bess and where he is in his evolution as a person. So if you put that in its proper context, it's palatable to everyone.
How as you went through the process of rehearsing it in the workshop and before it opened in Massachusetts, before it went to New York, how did all these pieces come together? Were you discovering them? Was she discovering them as you would sing a song or do a scene? Was she looking at that and going, no, I still haven't gotten this right, let me change this?
Well, I think we were really lucky to have a lot of creative artists in the room versus recreative artists in control of the piece. Recreative art, we all admire and adore. That's what's at the Metropolitan Opera. That's what the New York City Ballet. But then they also have the creative energy. So we're going to bring in new versions of operas. We're going to have new choreography. So I think, you know, them understanding having classic education in the arts, understanding what the basic material mm-hmm. was from a deep, deep place of experience. Susan Laurie Parks loves to talk about having seen Porgy and Bess as on film and being kind of repulsed yeah. by some of the early images of, you know, like the helpless, dirty black man who's just happy to be alive, whoa, you know, and that kind of thing. And then but also the love for the music at the same time. I think, I don't even remember what the question was. I'm so into Susan Laurie's
the process enveloped me. We only have 30 seconds.
She, you know, they know the basic opera. They know the full form. But then they have Our Black Bodies right here. So if you wouldn't do it today, don't do it today. And it's in you. You're telling the story with your body.
And because it's been pared down, and because the set is sparse, and because of the way they've constructed this, Porgy and Bess, the relationship between the two of them, comes down center for people. You really get a feel for who these people are, what their lives were like, and what this relationship is all about. Porgy and Bess plays at the Belk Theater through Sunday. BlumenthalArts.org for tickets. Nathaniel Stampley plays Porgy. Alicia Hall Moran plays Bess. I wish I had more time, but we're out. Thanks very much.